This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, Pervez Musharraf resigned as president of Pakistan. Russian President Medvedev thundered new threats while his Georgian counterpart adjusted his rhetoric sharply downward and appealed for talks with Moscow. And Iran reports the successful test of a rocket that can launch satellites into orbit. We hear these items as isolated data points, and while each is a story in its own right, if we can step back just a bit, they form part of a pattern, and each influences the other. Many Mondays on this program from now on, we're going to take time to talk with NPR's Ted Koppel about these patterns and what they mean. The longtime Nightline anchor is also now managing editor at Discovery. In a few minutes, former Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott will join us, and of course, we invite you into the conversation. Let's go light on the who, what, where, and when today. If you have questions about the hows and whys of international news, give us a phone call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also weigh in on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we're going to skip the opinion page this week to take some time to remember our friend and colleague, Leroy Sievers. But first, let me introduce Ted Koppel, as a regular on this program. He joins us from his office just outside of Washington, D.C. And Ted, let's begin where Casablanca ended and hope this is the beginning of a beautiful relationship.
I am sure it will be. Thank you, Neil.
And Ted, as we listen to those stories from Iran, from Moscow, and from Pakistan, what's the thread between them, do you see?
Well, let me take a really, really big step back to a story that I suspect is partly apocryphal, but there's certainly a hard kernel of truth in it. And that goes back to a time when the late president, prime minister, founding father of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, sent an anguished letter to Charles de Gaulle, because de Gaulle was moving in the direction of being friendlier towards some of the Arab states. And Ben-Gurion famously wrote, among other things, "I thought we were friends." And de Gaulle sent back a rather terse note that said, in effect, men have friends, nations have interests. If you consider simply the warm, close relationship that was said to exist between then-President Putin and our own President George W. Bush, when Bush famously said that he had looked into the eyes of Putin and seen his soul, when you consider all the wonderful things that were said about Musharraf by different senior members of the U.S. administration, you realize that personal relationships have very little to do with foreign policy. They can grease the wheels. They can make it easier for things to be achieved that are, in fact, in the national interest of the respective governments. But beyond that, personal relationships, forget about it.
joining us now here in Studio 3A is Strobe Talbott. He's the president of the Brookings Institution, former United States Deputy Secretary of State. And it's nice to have you in this conversation. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks, Neil. I'm glad to be part of a conversation with my old colleague and friend, Ted.
I was going to say, among the things you didn't say, Neil, is this man used to be a really first-class journalist before he went sour.
since he's gone over to the dark side, we can ask him some questions about these developments. Beginning today with Pakistan, as Ted says, reminded us with that story, the United States has important interests in Pakistan. It's a nuclear power next door to a nuclear power with whom it is constantly in confrontation, that, of course, India. It is absolutely critical to the conduct of the war in Afghanistan. It is involved in a war of its own with Islamic militants, including the Taliban. What are we to make of the resignation of Pervez Musharraf?
Well, on the one hand, it's welcome. It's kind of a clearing of the air and a clearing of the decks. As Ted alluded to this as well, Musharraf has been an extraordinarily problematic friend, to put it in polite Washington terms, of the United States. He has accommodated the United States insofar as we insisted on it and had leverage to make him accommodate us, but he was always playing a double game, always looking for ways to keep the more radical elements in his own political establishment, his intelligence services, his military, content by allowing them to make mischief in neighboring countries, whether it was Afghanistan or India inside of Kashmir, or even attacking the Indian Parliament back in 2001. So it was always a dicey game. Now, the melancholy point here, amidst all the celebrating going on in Pakistan, is what next? This is not a country that has ever been really, really steady or solid, and this Musharraf's departure does create a power vacuum, and we have to wait and see what the next military strongman will be and whether he'll stay in the barracks.
I think that's an awfully good point, Neil, because the while all the focus right now is on the former Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, and on Ali Bhutto's husband, Asif Ali Zardari, and whether or not the two of them, who, putting it very bluntly, can't stand each other, are able to form some kind of a coalition. In reality, as Strobe just said, the decisions are going to be made by the military. They are still the power. They are still the force.
Yet we heard recently that the ISI, the previously described as all-powerful intelligence services, have been brought under the control of the prime minister, of the civilian government.
I'll believe it when I see it, and even then I'm not sure I'll believe it, to be perfectly honest. I don't know Mr. Zardari, but I certainly know Nawaz Sharif. I worked with him, and sometimes I might add against him, because he was a very tough customer to deal with. And one of the things that made him so tough back in the 1990s is that he was always, and he was very forthright about this, he was terrified of what the military was going to do behind his back, with good reason, as it turned out to be. He probably didn't have as much to do as Musharraf did in launching an extraordinarily reckless and dangerous military operation against India in 1998.
Musharraf, then the head of the army.
Musharraf, who was then, right, head of the army staff before he basically threw Nawaz Sharif out and came into power. And so I doubt that Nawaz Sharif has changed that much. And the fact that he's in a very, very loose and no doubt mutually suspicious relationship in this coalition arrangement doesn't argue for a lot of stability there.
Let me turn back to the other big news story of, the past week or so, and that, of course, the confrontation between Georgia and Russia, and a speech today that Dmitry Medvedev, the titular president of Russia, said, "If anyone thinks they can kill our citizens and escape unpunished, we will never allow this. If anyone tries this again, we will come out with a crushing response. We have all the necessary resources, political, economic, and military." That in an address to veterans of the Second World War in the Russian city of Kursk. That, of course, the site of one of the great battles of the Second World War and symbolic importance itself. Dmitry Medvedev, the United States dismissing this kind of talk as bluster, yet that's pretty strong-sounding stuff.
It's also very popular bluster inside of Russia. I think that's a key point to bear in mind here. While Russia is more pluralistic than it was back in the days when Ted and I were bouncing around on airplanes following Henry Kissinger to that part of the world, it is still, there's a huge outpouring of nationalism now, and a lot of that nationalism, I think, lines up behind what is essentially Putin's war, and Medvedev is just on that bandwagon.
I think also, Neil, there is a phrase or a slogan from the real estate business that can be applied to foreign policy, and that is, it's location, location, location. It's one thing when Washington these days sounds tough, that's bluster. When Moscow these days sounds tough, they're close enough to put that into effect. I mean, together with that bluster, the Russians have also put short-range missiles in a position where they could hit, if they chose to, the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. That may be bluster, but it's bluster with a punch. And the problem is that the United States and Western Europe are limited to symbolic actions right now, more than the possibility of taking any kind of military counteraction.
We're talking about developments in the international news cycle with Strobe Talbott, the former Deputy Secretary of State, former journalist, as we've been reminded several times, and now the head of the Brookings Institution. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and with us for the first of many Mondays is Ted Koppel, the former longtime anchor at Nightline and now Talk of the Nation's news analyst. And Ted, getting back to patterns in the news, what unites this story in Pakistan and this story on the southern fringes of Russia?
Well, I mean, you can lay out a couple of issues that unite it. One that unites just about every nasty thing that's happening in the world today is oil. The fact of the matter is that the Russians over the past few years have become far more influential, are able to throw their weight around with far greater impact than they were even 5 or 8 or 10 years ago, because of the enormous wealth that they have gained from their richness in oil and natural gas. The other issue, of course, is nuclear weapons. The Russians still have them in great abundance. And that other trouble spot that we've been talking about, Pakistan, you already mentioned, Neil, I think, that Pakistan and India are both nuclear powers. Anything that goes badly wrong out there has the capability of instantly turning into a nuclear war. But the reason we need to be particularly concerned about what happens politically inside Pakistan right now is that one of our great fears has been, and we've been looking at the possibility that Al-Qaeda might get its hands on some weapon of mass destruction, the possibility that Islamic fundamentalists in Pakistan would gain sufficient power so that they might ultimately have access to and control over Pakistan's nuclear weapons. That's something that I suspect gave Strobe nightmares when he was at the State Department and continues to give nightmares to senior officials in the Bush administration.
Another development, a rather small item in the newspaper this morning, that Iran had successfully test-fired a missile they call Safir, a rocket which is capable of launching a satellite into space. They want to put up communication satellites. Of course, that's what the Russians said about their space program in 1958 when Sputnik went up, and the realization was soon dawned on everybody in the United States that if you can launch a satellite into orbit, you can launch an intercontinental ballistic missile over thousands of miles. And this is a development that prompted, well, I think within 2 years, there was already a debate over the missile gap in the 1960 presidential election, a debate which turned out to have been a little bit phonied up, as the case was. But nevertheless, Iran's pending nuclear developments, this is another thing we'll talk about when we continue our conversation with Strobe Talbott, the former Deputy Secretary of State, and now at the Brookings Institution, Ted Koppel will stay with us, of course. We'd like you to join the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We're talking about international news stories. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, despite repeated protests from Washington, Russian tanks continue to roll inside Georgia's borders, while in Pakistan, the government there prepares for its future after President Pervez Musharraf. Our focus today is on the connections between these international news stories and what these patterns mean. Ted Koppel is with us. He's managing editor at the Discovery Channel and Talk of the Nation's news analyst. We're joined also by Strobe Talbott, former United States Deputy Secretary of State, now president of the Brookings Institution. If you'd like to talk with him about the hows and whys of international news, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. We'll start with Ali. Ali's with us from Cherry Hill in New Jersey.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I would like to say that your guest analyst, Ted Koppel, and his friend, they're beyond wrong to say that the military is still in charge and they will make the next move, or they're in charge of some kind of decision-making. It's not right. If military could have done anything, they would have saved President Musharraf, and the current army chief is very highly professional man and who have no political ambition. And plus, the country will not tolerate any military intervention. Now, the country, after removal of Chief Justice, is a different Pakistan, you know. So to say the military will still interfere with the, political situation of the country is very wrong.
Just to clarify, Ali is talking about a very unpopular move that then-President Musharraf made to remove all the Supreme Court justices and many other justices who disagreed with him.
Yes, that was the beginning of his
Well, maybe the final straw, not the beginning. But anyway, Strobe Talbott, why do you think you're right?
Yeah, well, Ali, just to clarify, I don't think either Ted or I said that the military was now in charge. I did assert, and I would assert again, that politicians, that is civilian elected politicians in Pakistan, have in the past had very good reasons to worry about the military taking over, because it's happened a number of times. And I am absolutely sure that the current civilian leadership is going to look over its shoulder at the military headquarters in Rawalpindi with exactly the same kind of concern. Now, that said, I think it is a terrific credit to the people of Pakistan, and particularly to the very brave magistrates and lawyers who basically came out into the streets and forced this change in the situation there. We have to hope that'll continue, and whether it does continue will depend in no small measure on whether civilian rule has unambiguous support from the United States, because in the past there's been a tendency of American presidents of both parties to support military leaders in Pakistan.
And I think one of the other questions, Neil, is going to be, is there going to be a clear and unambiguous civilian leadership? You know, the famous notion about nature abhorring a vacuum is also true in politics. Unless there can be a clear civilian leadership, the army may find itself in a position where it has to step in.
Well, the question there is, one of the remarks that President Musharraf made today in his speech where he announced his resignation was that the civilian leadership that's currently in power has been singularly unsuccessful in its attempts to prosecute the war against the Islamic militants in the Northwest Territories and the tribal areas. The army would seem to be conflicted here. Do they want them to succeed in this conflict where they've been supporting some of these people for some of these groups very, very well, with money, with weapons, with training?
Well, it wasn't just the civilian leadership that came in recent months that was conflicted in that way, or that was unsuccessful in that way. The Pakistani military and intelligence services themselves were riven with ambivalence. And if Musharraf succeeded in tamping down their support, say, for the Taliban or al-Qaeda, largely because he came under such pressure from the United States, he allowed them to raise even more mischief on the other border, which is to say with India and Kashmir.
And tens of thousands of people protesting in Kashmir just this past week. So let's get another caller on the line, and this is Jim calling us from Reno in Nevada.
Yes, hi. Gentlemen, thank you for the program. I really appreciate that. And I just have a simple question here about the so-called Russian invasion of Georgia. Now, I really don't hear as much about the 15 peacekeepers that were killed, Russian peacekeepers that were killed in South Ossetia. And this, as far as I know, this is what set the whole thing off. Am I correct in that assumption?
There's some dispute as to the exact timing of what happened when, whose troops moved first, who fired the first shot. It does appear that both sides were more than ready to move in at the opening bell, and the Russians were certainly there. What, in a day or two after the Georgians moved into South Ossetia?
Jim, this is Strobe. I'd go a little bit further than Neil just did and say that I think we know enough now to be able to confidently assert that Russia had a strategy to sucker punch the Georgians into this war. That is to say, while the situation is complicated and we need to wait until their international observers and monitors, if they can ever get into all of Georgia, which includes, by the way, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, to get all the facts known. But we now know enough to be pretty sure that there was a systematic attempt on the part of the Russians to provoke this war.
It sounds like a systematic approach on our part to invade a sovereign country like Iraq, for example. And that's why I just don't understand all this bluster and bluff on the part of the United States, where we can invade a sovereign country, and the world looks upon us as they took out a bad man, Saddam Hussein, but nonetheless, it was a sovereign country, and he was no threat to us, and certainly, didn't go around killing Americans at that point. That country was totally contained.
Let me come in for a moment on Jim's side here and try to provoke my old friend Strobe. If you add to what Jim just said, the fact that the United States has been considering NATO membership for not only Georgia but also Ukraine, that the United States supported the independence of Kosovo over the objections of the Serbians and their Russian sponsors. You know, if you looked at it from the Kremlin's point of view, the United States has been meddling in their backyard, and this may be their way of saying, keep your nose out of here.
Well, you've eloquently spoken for the Kremlin on that, my old friend Ted. but look, let's put I'd put Iraq into a slightly different category from the other points that you and Jim are raising. I am very critical, always have been very critical of the United States in defiance of the Security Council, all of our allies except Britain, going in and what turned out to be the basis of faulty intelligence, to put it mildly, invading and occupying Iraq. I would not agree with Jim that Saddam posed no threat to the United States. He posed a considerable threat to the United States. But I do think that the international opposition, which is reflected here in the United States to the conduct of the Iraq War, weakens our ability to, as it were, lecture or wag our fingers at the Russians on this. But going to the merits, if we were hypersensitive to the Russians and their tender feelings on such things as what neighboring states have a right to do, like apply for membership in NATO and the European Union, that whole part of the world would still virtually be part of an Iron Curtain evil empire. And we've left that stage of history behind us. Georgia and Ukraine are independent sovereign states and are recognized to be such up to a point, in the case of Georgia, by Russia, certainly in the case of Ukraine. And they are entitled to join international institutions. So it wasn't just a matter of us promoting it. And by the way, I think that one of the results of what the Russians have done in Georgia is that you're going to see a lot of other countries around Russia's periphery saying, boy, we can really see the value of being part of the Western alliance. And, Neil, you're looking for ways of connecting the dots. This brings us in a way to the Iran missile launch today, which is to say one of the immediate effects of what the Russians did in Georgia was Poland getting over its ambivalence about whether to have a missile defense system of the United States on its own territory. And one of the reasons it did that is because it's now more frightened of Russia than it was before. And incidentally, it's probably a little more frightened of Iran as a result of the so-called satellite launches. We all know, according to Newtonian physics, that what goes up can also come down. And you made the connection to the Soviet Sputniks, and you might also recall that the North Korean missile program got its start as a supposed satellite launch.
Can I jump in just to concede that Strobe has forgotten more about the old Soviet Union and Russia than I have ever known? He is truly one of this country's great Sovietologists and Russian experts. Having said that, I think while we're in the dot-connecting department, we also need to point out that the United States has been backing this oil pipeline that comes through Georgia from Baku on the Caspian Sea and over Russian objections was going to pass through Georgia and ultimately come out in the Black Sea without ever touching Russian territory. Oil is one of those dots that keeps cropping up again and again and again.
But, Ted, if I could just quickly come in on that. Precisely because the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline that you're referring to did not pass through Russia was a way of assuring Western Europe and other parts of the world diversification of oil sources. And one of the reasons I think that the Russians went into Georgia was to push back against that diversification so that Western Europe would be more reliant on Russia.
You and I are in total agreement on that. I'm simply pointing out that that is one of the things that was taking the Russians off, and that is that it would provide more independence for the Europeans than if the Europeans are totally dependent on them.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the conversation.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk with Ted. Ted's with us from Carruthers in California.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Well, you guys just hit on my topic. And when I saw this, then the news popped about Russia cruising down into Georgia, and I started looking around. I got very interested in the two pipelines that go through Georgia. As you mentioned, the Baku, whatever, the one that goes to the Black Sea, which then oil is sent to Odessa and then on to Europe, And then the other one that goes down through Turkey, that goes through Georgia and then goes down through Turkey. Now, 6 days or so before this whole thing blew up, that was a poor choice of words, the pipeline in Turkey, a terminal or the pipeline itself was blown up and put out of commission. I think that that's interesting timing. So I think that looking at the situation and Russia deciding to roll tanks and put men down in there, I think it has very little to do with South Ossetia. I think what it boils down to is, I mean, if they can get oil to go up $20 a barrel, then they're going to get an extra $20 million a day coming into their treasury. So, I mean, that's a good reason to saddle up and roll down into Georgia, in my opinion. I don't really think this has anything to do with South Ossetia or the other region whose name escapes me.
Abkhazia, and one of many reasons, perhaps. Ted, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
We're talking with Ted Koppel, the managing editor of the Discovery Channel and former anchor of ABC News Nightline, now the talk news analyst here at Talk of the Nation. And our guest is Strobe Talbott, president of the Brookings Institution, former United States Deputy Secretary of State. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Bill's on the line. Bill calling from Chicago.
Yes, gentlemen. Great topic today. I was wondering how you view the U.S. approaching diplomacy in the 21st century in dealing with countries where we may not have any leverage. I talked to your screener specifically about Iran and kind of my nightmare scenario where Ahmadinejad or whoever might be in charge of Iran at any given point would say, you know what, we're willing to negotiate with you. The only condition we set is that you drop all your support for Israel. I'm just kind of wondering in this weird 21st century world, what kind of challenges you see the U.S. facing in terms of nightmare situations like that where we have no leverage. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay. Strobe Talbott, let me just rephrase that just slightly. In the past 2 years, you've heard some people say, you know, gee, wasn't it better when it was the old, bipolar world? Things were a lot simpler then. Well, be careful what you asked for. Among other institutions, the United Nations Security Council is going to be very different this week than it was last week.
Well, I still don't think, Neil, that that's any reason to be nostalgic for the Cold War and the so-called bipolar world. Remember that what we were worried about then was global thermonuclear holocaust. And while we've got some serious problems, including ones having to do with nuclear weapons, it is, bottom line, I think, a safer world than it was when the United States and the Soviet Union were at dagger's point. Going to Bill's question, I don't quite accept the premise that we have no leverage with Iran. Iran is a complicated country. It is not just Ahmadinejad, who is as wacky as he is dangerous. There's no question about that. But I think he's so wacky and dangerous that he's even made some of his own conservative clerics nervous and has perhaps been reined in a little bit. And Iran has also got a fairly vigorous and quite young population that I think is straining against the constraints of theocratic rule. That's an argument for trying to find ways of engaging with them over time, which doesn't mean making deals with unacceptable people like Ahmadinejad, but it does mean engaging with the government.
And let me ask you also a question about the future of Russia, which, if we've pointed out, is immensely wealthy because of its wealth of petroleum and natural gas and has got strong new leadership in Vladimir Putin. Nevertheless, you look at the long-term prospects for Russia. Its population continues to decline. Petroleum and gas, well, they will run out eventually. Is this something the United States and its allies in Europe can simply wait out for the time being?
Well, they shouldn't wait it out. We should engage with them in the meantime. But you make a very good point, Neil, which is Russia does not have a modern economy. It doesn't have a modern service sector. It doesn't have a modern manufacturing sector. And it doesn't have rule of law. And that means in the final analysis, it's going to depend very, very much on being able to gain acceptance from international investors and in the international community. And that hasn't changed in the past week.
And how far do you think they are going to push the situation in Georgia? We saw President Saakashvili today say we should have talks with our northern neighbor, considerably milder language than he's used in the past 10 days.
Which is to be welcomed, by the way. I think that it is at least possible, Neil, I'm going to go a little bit on a limb here, that X months from now, Russia may look back on this rollover victory that it feels it has in Georgia as more of a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, it is paying a price in terms of the international outcry. They've managed to unite the United States and our European friends to a new extent. Back in the days when the Russians were rolling into places like Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Afghanistan, we didn't say to ourselves, what's the effect on the Soviet stock market? And yet the Russian stock market, where a lot of Russians have money, has taken a drubbing as a result of this. All that has to be borne in mind.
Strobe Talbott, thank you so much for your time today. We do appreciate it. Strobe Talbott is now the president of the Brookings Institution. He's a former United States Deputy Secretary of State. He joined us here in Studio 3A. We're going to ask Ted Koppel to stay with us. Coming up, we remember a good friend and a colleague. Many of you met and got to know Leroy Sievers on his My Cancer blog. And by listening to him here on Talk of the Nation, what did Leroy Sievers and My Cancer mean to you? 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.